This podcast is brought to you by Motorola.
D U D E. Dude. Dude. Okay. Send to entire address book. Sending. Sending. Sent. Excellent. That's gnarly, dude. Tubular.
Hey, Shane. How you doing tonight?
Doing good, Rod. How are you?
Good. And for our listeners, this is show number 5 of The Atomic Show, where Shane Brown and Rod Adams talk about atomic geeky stuff.
Yep. And one of the things that we've been talking about offline, and we're just hashing out ideas for a show that we wanted to do tonight, and I realized that, you know, we hadn't really talked very much about ionizing radiation itself, ionizing being to distinguish it from what comes off of a cell phone or a flashlight, for instance, in ways that nuclear industry and nuclear professionals measure it, and the fact that if you can balance your checkbook, or if you can even add numbers, it's not all that difficult for you to understand radiation. It's just a matter of learning some terms.
Okay, well, let's talk about things. Isn't radiation something we should all be afraid of? Isn't that what we've been told for years and years, that there is no safe level of radiation?
And that radiation is a completely artificial, man-made phenomenon that it does the devil's work and is responsible for causing cows to stop eating and stop giving milk and people to fall over and turn green and rampage through town.
Yeah, it makes all that green ooze and really scary stuff in old B-movies.
So that's the Hollywood version. So what about the reality? Now, the reality, as I understand it from 10 years of reading, 15 years of reading, is that radioactive materials are, in general, extremely boring to look at. And if they're actually glowing and you're next to it unshielded, you're not going to be around long to observe it. But very few radioactive materials are actually, quote-unquote, hot enough to glow in air. And the physical causes of that glow is very neat. It's actually analogous to an airplane breaking the sound barrier. But getting back to the original topic, so there are three kinds of ionizing radiation.
Now let's hold on just for a little bit. Now,
okay.
If we want to talk about stuff that glows, we do know there are a couple of radioactive materials that do have a nice glow, and that glow was used quite nicely in certain kinds of products, wasn't it?
Well,
or was it the reaction between the radiation and something else that made the glow in the radium dial watches and the tritium exit lights on airplanes?
Yeah, thanks for catching me, Rod. I got a little bit ahead of myself. As a matter of fact, it's funny. I used to work in a place where they had tritium exit signs, and as a matter of fact, in Britain they sell tritium lit keychains. They're called tracers, and I've been wanting to lay hold of one for a long time, but there are export or import restrictions that the NRC has put in place that prevent private citizens from acquiring tritium lit keychains that you can never lose because it's a quote unquote frivolous use of tritium.
I don't know about you, but I lose my keys all the time. I'd love to have something that helped me find them in the dark.
And you cannot beat something that stays lit up to 50% of its original brightness after 12 years. Plus the fact that tritium, as far as I remember, tritium is the lowest energy emission radioisotope. It emits an electron at such a low level that if it were inside of a cell, it wouldn't break the cell wall. It just bounced.
Wow, that's interesting. It definitely is a low energy beta emitter, very easy to shield. But if tritium doesn't break the cell wall, we may have to come back to that one a little bit.
Yeah.
I may be remembering
that wrong. It may be that because tritium is a form of hydrogen, and if you get hydrogen in the form of water into your body, then your picking up an internal disk. But again, we're getting ahead of ourselves, and I may have misremembered that from an anti-nuke publication charge to thought.
Don't let yourself get contaminated by reading all that trash. Anyway, I know I read it all the time myself just to find out what they're talking about. Okay, so we have the tritium exit signs, tritium was also used in the 50s for some really nice sign work that was very useful on highways. Always lit, even if you didn't have your headlights shining on it, you could read the signs.
Yep, and I remember reading in a book from the 70s, it was talking about nuclear applications. They also use Krypton 85 for that purpose and sealed glass tubes about the size of your pinky that were coated on the inside with phosphor, just like a fluorescent tube, and they dotted these like a dot matrix around the outlines of the numbers. And what's interesting to me is that Krypton 85 is a fission product. It's one of those materials that people consider waste.
One of those rare materials with unique physical properties that I think must have some value, because that's what rare materials with unique physical properties have in general, as long as you find somebody who's got that sense of converting somebody's trash into somebody else's treasure.
So how do we measure how much trash can convert into how much treasure? That might be a good lead-in for how do people measure it, and how much converts you, how much, at what point do you need to start worrying?
That's a good question. Generally speaking, it is pretty darned easy to measure extremely low doses of radiation, because what we basically do is to watch the path of the radioactive particle through a chamber. That was the earliest form of detector. What was that called?
An electroscope?
Yeah, something like that.
Or a cloud chamber, too.
The cloud chamber is what I'm thinking of. That was the earliest detector. You could almost see each individual particle tracing its way through the clouds.
There was also a neat novelty device back then that they sold as a parlor game. It's called a spintheroscope. I don't know if you've ever heard of these, but as a matter of fact, there are a few places online where you can buy them. Then they have a very, very small sample of americium, which is a smoke detector source, behind a phosphor screen. And if you take this device, it's like a view graph or whatever, where you just stare down into it like a kaleidoscope or a microscope, and you get into a very, very dark room with it. And once your eyes adapt to the darkness, you can actually see the individual green sparks of scintillation coming from the alphas coming off the americium impacting on the phosphor.
That sounds like a neat toy. I think I'm going to ask for one for Christmas. These days, I guess the most common radiation detector and the one that people are most familiar with is called a Geiger counter. And I'm going to leave it to you to explain a little bit about how a Geiger counter works, because I've forgotten.
Well, it's interesting how a Geiger counter works. It's a lot like how lightning works. So this is something that I learned a few years ago. Why is lightning jagged? And why is any electrical arc between two contacts always jagged? And I wondered about that and wondered about it and wondered about it. And then I found this wonderful book, and for the life of me, I cannot remember the name of the book. But it explained that the reason why lightning is jagged is because as the electrons start moving from cloud to ground or ground to cloud, depending upon what kind of lightning it is, the electrons look for the path of least resistance. And because the Earth is being bombarded by cosmic rays from space all the time, all those rays coming in at random directions make all these crisscrossing paths through the atmosphere. And where those paths interact is where the lightning jags and jigs. So it follows all of these switching, crossing paths of cosmic rays moving through the atmosphere.
So the lightning is taking the easiest path to ground, even though it looks like a long path.
Yep, because the cosmic rays are providing individually ionized channels. And they all connect together because there are a fair number of cosmic rays, although nowhere near enough to hurt you. But that leads me into my description of how a Geiger counter works, in that it's just a chamber that's filled with gas. It's a lot like a TV tube or a light bulb, but it's filled with the gas that insulates. It's, I can't remember the composition, but it's usually a gas that's really hard to start an arc in, where you, if you were to put a very high potential across it, it would take a lot more voltage than it does in air to create a spark. And so with that voltage in there, Geiger counters usually work at a very high voltage. And it's this charged tube, which has a little needle inside surrounded by a conducting metal cylinder that doesn't touch it anywhere. And they're separated by insulators, and they're separated by the insulating gas. So you have this tube that's charged up, and there's some electronics that's hooked up to the end of it, and it hooks to a meter, and there's a whole bunch of electronics that I'm not even going to get into. But fundamentally how it works is that this charge is sitting there just waiting for some way to leap across the boundary, to leap across this moat of insulating gas. And then, say a particle of radiation, one of the three kinds that we can talk about in a few minutes, comes through this tube and creates a path, just like the cosmic rays do with lightning. And if they create a path that passes close enough to the needle, there will be a jump of electrons. Some electrons will start moving, not very many, because this is a very conductive gas. So it will just create this jump in current, and the jump in current is measured back in the electronics, and it causes the needle to flicker, or the display to change because there's a little computer in it if it's a digital Geiger counter.
And usually the Geiger counters are set up to have an audio feedback also, so you hear a little click.
Click, 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 click.
Yeah, the rate of that helps you determine whether you've got a small amount of radiation or a larger amount of radiation. And when you're doing surveys, it makes it very nice to have those clicks fed to you via headphones. That way you can walk around and not have to look at the meter all the time. It makes it safer to do surveys, not because of the radiation issue, but because you don't bump into things so easily.
Right. You're not staring down at the meter rather than watching your feet, because you're wandering around in an industrial environment where you need to be watching where you're going.
Yeah, it makes a big difference on board a submarine, because there's always things you can bump your head on or bump your knees on.
Interesting. So, Geiger counters. Geiger counters are actually available all over the internet. If you do a search for Geiger counter on Google, and Google actually has a service called Frugal where you can actually price things. It's meant for comparison shopping. And I've used that to price Geiger counters. And there are a bunch of really nice digital counters that you can get from Russia. The Russians have been making digital Geiger counters for the last 10 or 15 years. They're a lot bulkier than the American counterparts, but they are dirt cheap. And I've seen a couple of them that sell for less than $100 for ones that go through two orders of magnitude.
They're probably pretty durable.
Oh yeah, that's,
you know,
that's
Russian engineering tends to be nice and bulky and
stout.
Yeah,
the proverbial brick outhouse.
And one of the things that is very important for people to understand with regard to radiation is that the levels that we can measure are extremely tiny, and that's one of the reasons why radioactive tracers are used in medical procedures, because we can tag certain kinds of elements by picking a radioactive version of that isotope and actually watch exactly how your body responds and how that fluid that's tagged with that very small amount of radiation flows through your body.
Mm-hmm. I remember discovering the equation, or finding the equation for how to convert between the amount of a radioactive substance measured by how many counts per second you're getting from it in the Curie, and how much mass of that substance is actually present. I was playing with this equation, and I happened to plug in a number for one of those tracers that you mentioned. It's fluorine-18. It's used in PET scans or positron emission tomography scans. It's actually a real-world use of antimatter, but I'll get to that in a second. But what was amazing to me is that, okay, a 10 millicurie dose of this stuff costs $600 at the UNM hospital here in Albuquerque. And 10 millicuries sounds, you have no idea for how much it is until you run the numbers and realize that's 10 billionths of a gram. $600 for 10 billionths of a gram. That's
sounds
some
like
fairly
a good business
expensive
to be
stuff.
In.
Oh, yeah.
One of the reasons that radioactive materials cost so much is because we have such tight controls on how they're used, and the amount of paperwork that goes into them is pretty incredible. There's also only a couple of sources of medical isotopes, even though there's lots and lots of potential sources that we lock up and call waste.
Yep. I was going through it was an online repository that the Department of Energy maintains, and they have all these documents that are available for public comment. It's called osti.gov is the name of the website. If you go there and search on Glenn Seaborg, who is the discoverer of plutonium, he actually wrote a bunch of these speeches that was collected all into one place. It was a collection of his speeches that covered various aspects of atomic energy from the late 60s through the early 70s. And one of the neatest applications I saw was this idea of a wood-plastic hybrid, where you take a really crappy wood, like balsa or scrub pine or anything that has a really low strength, low resistance to termites, and take your pick of bad properties. And you saturate it in this liquid that has a bunch of just little hydrocarbons distributed in the liquid and let the wood soak it up. Then you take the piece of wood out and expose it to a strong radiation flux, a gamma flux from, say, cobalt. And then after a certain dose is reached, all those molecules that penetrated the wood start cross-linking and forming polymers, plastic. So it fills in all the pores of the wood with plastic. So that now this wood is two or three times stronger than it was before. It is completely impervious to termites, and you can leave it in salt water for days without having it warp, twist, or split. And I have no idea whatever happened to that technology.
Oh, I have a pretty good idea why it didn't go forward. But, a lot of other things that could be useful for that amount of radiation. I really love the idea of sterilizing food by exposing it to high doses of radiation. And been invested for a number of years in a small company down in Florida. It started off its life known as Vindicator. Eventually changed its name to Food Technology Services. Mm-hmm. But they've been irradiating food and medical products and that kind of stuff for, 15 or 20 years. And they have a tremendous little enterprise that does some very good stuff. But they have difficulty selling their products, because many groceries think that people don't want to buy them.
Right.
Although every time they put them on the shelf, they seem to
they
fly
get
off the
up.
Shelf.
So what they need to do is stop listening to the marketers who are, the question is, who's driving that? Is it marketers who are saying this would be economic suicide for the chain? Or is it some anti-nuke action group that is going out and proactively nipping these things in the bud before they ever get a chance to sprout?
Yeah, I don't know. But anyway, back to the whether we should be afraid of radiation or not. It's also important for people to know that, humans grew up developed, evolved, were created, whatever you want to call it. We are here on an Earth that has always been radioactive. There are a number of naturally occurring and naturally repeating sources of radiation. And on average, a person in the United States will get a dose rate every year of approximately 200 to 300 millirem. And one of the things, obviously, in any new topic for people is to learn the units of measure.
Absolutely.
So a millirem is a 1/1000th of a Rankine equivalent man. And I can't remember what a Rankine equivalent man is supposed to tell you anymore. But it's not a very big amount of radiation.
The way I remember it is that Rankine equivalent man is calculated from rads, where rads is, I think it's either ergs or calories of energy deposited per gram of water or some mass. So how radiation affects you is as it passes in through your body, it's stopped by some of the molecules in your body, and depending upon what it stops in, it could stop in a cell, or it could stop in a blood vessel, or it could stop anywhere. And then as it comes to a stop, it deposits energy. And as you add up all those little teeny tiny sums of energy, you come up with a dose. And that's where you get rads, or which was the original unit, and then the more recent units that came along with the metric system were grays and sieverts. But we won't get into that. But the equivalent between rad and rem is that rem, there's some quality factor multiplying onto the rad depending upon the relative damage that different kinds of radiation do. Like alphas do a lot more damage in tissue than gammas, but they also stop a lot more easily.
Yeah, it tends to be the stuff that's very high energy, but very large and large high ionization, like an alpha, which has a positive 2 charge, doesn't go very far because it interacts with lots of matter.
And before people think that alphas are this strange and alien material, an alpha is just the nucleus of a helium atom, clocking along at 10,000 miles a second when it flies out of a nucleus, and then comes to a stop and finds a couple of electrons and then finds its way out of the atmosphere. And this happens every day, billions upon trillions upon quadrillions of times. It's just neat to me is that all the helium that we get, which incidentally comes from just a 250-kilometer radius area centered on Amarillo, Texas, is the helium capital of the world. All that helium bubbled up into these natural gas reservoirs from the deep inside the Earth, from where thorium and uranium have been decaying for a long time. But that's off topic. So 250 millirem is the dose for an average adult in the United States per year. Now, compare that 250 millirem, which is a quarter of a rem. Going from millirem to rem, you have to divide by 1,000. So a quarter of a rem. How much does it take to actually cause damage to somebody where they will start showing symptoms of radiation sickness? And the number I remember, and you can, of course, correct me if I'm wrong, but to cause a fatality in 50% of the people exposed to the dose takes 450 rem, assuming you're healthy.
Yeah, that's what they call an acute dose. In other words, 450 rem over a short period of time.
Which is 1,800 times the yearly dose that people get in the United States.
Yep. And the normal limit for exposure to occupational type doses is on the order of, about 5 rem per year is the maximum, but most nuclear power plants and nuclear power programs have significantly lower control doses than that. But there's been a lot of studies of the effects of low-level radiation that show that for doses less than about 10 rem, which is
40 times the current background,
there is essentially no measurable effect. A lot of folks that have done a lot of research believe that that number may even be higher if the doses are low doses and accumulate much slowly. And the reason for that is that if radiation is a natural part of our environment, people have been exposed to it for a long period of time, and matter of fact, we always had radiation around, that we have some amount of resistance to it and some amount of ability to recover from any damage that may occur because of exposure. And there's also a notion that's fairly well supported by data that says that when you're below a certain level, what you have is a hormesis effect. Hormesis means that just a little bit is probably good for you because it stimulates other response. Sort of like taking Sort of like taking one aspirin. Taking one aspirin is probably a good thing on a regular basis. Taking a whole bottle of aspirin is probably not a good thing.
Mm. And the same thing happens with trace elements that people need in their diets. And selenium is required by the human body in very, very small quantities, but if you get into quantities that you can see, then it'll hurt you because it's a heavy metal.
The dose makes the poison.
Absolutely. So probably one of my favorite studies to argue for the hormetic effect. There's a study done on this group of 10,000 people living in Taiwan. We're living in apartment buildings. These apartment buildings were built in a very short period of time, and it provided almost a perfect scientific epidemiological laboratory, unintentionally, and all the people who were involved were compensated by the Taiwan government. But what happened was some of these buildings were 10,000 of the 2 million people who were living in these apartment complexes. The steel rebar that went into the apartments was contaminated with cobalt-60 that had been scrapped and allowed to mix in with the steel. So the result was that the rebar that went into these apartments made background radiation levels inside the apartments about 10 or 20 times higher than normal Taiwan background. So then the scientists went in and said, well, obviously, according to the linear no-threshold theory, there should be a linearly predictable increase in the rate of cancers over the following 20 years. And what they actually found was that the rate of cancer among the population that was living in the hot, quote-unquote, apartments was just 3% of what it was in the cool apartments. Taking all the statistical adjustments and confounding factors and things into account. That's a very simplistic way of putting it, but that's the take-home number that I kept.
There's also a similar study that I've written about in my blog, and I can't remember all the details, but we had a study done of the nuclear shipyard workers versus people who had almost exactly the same job in a non-nuclear shipyard. So we had a control group versus a group of folks that had some occupational radiation exposures. And that study was done over a long period of time. What it showed was that essentially controlling for all other variables, the nuclear shipyard workers were measurably healthier over a long period of time than the non-nuclear shipyard workers. And for a number of reasons that have to do with a lot of politics, that study was never completely published. Summaries have been published by the folks that were involved, but the Department of Energy, the agency that sponsored the study, never released the results. And I have lots of reasons why I think that that might have occurred, but the fact of the matter was that they were looking for, what they say is they were looking for any negative effects so that they could protect the workers, and when they found that there weren't any, they simply said, okay, study's over, funding's gone.
Interesting.
Again, please remember, folks, that the amount of radiation that you can measure starts off at a number that would be roughly equivalent to pennies on a scale that goes up to trillions of dollars. Okay? So if you understand the number of orders of magnitude there, there are levels below which there's nothing to worry about. And one of the biggest tragedies associated with radiation is that people have bad health effects caused by worry about doses that are well below the normal background dosage.
Look at the symptoms that were going on in Western Europe and in the Scandinavian countries after Chernobyl. A whole bunch of people got extremely upset and very anxious, and there were people who did all kinds of things. There were people, not only for that, but also for Three Mile Island, who went out and had themselves sterilized because they thought that because this had happened, then the place where they were living had become unclean somehow, and they would never be able to have normal children.
Well, that itself is a tragedy, but even greater tragedy was the number of therapeutic, quote, abortions that were requested after the Chernobyl incident.
Yep.
And that number is in the thousands of people whose lives stopped because somebody was afraid and they weren't given good, solid, scientifically supportable information to let them know that whatever dangers they were exposed to were very minor.
That's sobering.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are folks in the world who have natural background radiation. That's something else we need to say, is that the natural background radiation varies by quite a bit. There are some places where the background radiation provides approximately 4 rem per year. That's 4,000 millirem.
16 times the U.S. background.
Darn, you're good with that radcon math stuff. Yes, and the people who live in those areas do not show any excessive health effects from living in that kind of background.
There's beaches in India where the sand that all these Brit tourists and tourists from Europe who go to India on vacation all the time go and hang out on and go vacationing on, the sand is actually an ore of thorium. It's called monazite. It's just weird looking black sand, and there's also a little bit of it in North Carolina. And there are places in the world where that's happened. And there's also a place in the world where, wonder of wonders, Mother Nature herself operated a nuclear reactor.
Yes. But, that's Oklo, I believe, in Africa.
Yep.
Another word that you can search for on Google that will provide you a very interesting evening of reading. O-K-L-O. Look for Oklo Reactor, and you'll find the story of a natural fission reactor that operated for probably, what, several million years? Is that correct?
I've heard numbers ranging from 500,000 to several million. So what would happen is this way, 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 way back when the Earth
was... Got to get in the Wayback Machine for that, huh?
Oh, yeah. Way, way, way back. When the Earth was new, the uranium that was in the Earth's crust, which we've talked about before, is made of two different isotopes, uranium-238, which has a half-life of 4.5 billion years, and uranium-235, which has a half-life of 700 million years.
So that means that 235 is decaying.
Decaying faster. So what happened is way back when the uranium isotope composition was different. At that time, natural uranium that you could find on the surface of the Earth was actually the same isotopic composition as we use in light water commercial power reactors today. So what happened was all these veins of uranium ore in this place, which would eventually become Africa a long, long time later, were infiltrated, had groundwater seep into them. And groundwater, being a moderator, started a reaction in the uranium. And this uranium would heat up the water into steam, and then the steam would drive off and the reaction would stop. And then it would just pulse. Water creep in, water turn to steam, water leave. And it did this for a long time. And there's a bunch of different lessons for people to take away from this. Number one, fission is a natural process. It's not something evil that people cooked up to hurt people. Number two, all of the fission products that were produced in that place, which were just completely random, no containment, no engineering, nothing, stayed within several feet of the places where they originated for the following many, many, many millions of years that's been since the Oklo reactor was operating. And the reason why we know there were fission products is because we can see all these weird stable isotopes where none should be, right in the same place where with all this uranium ore that is curiously depleted in 235.
That's because it fissioned early and then continued to decay away.
Yep. So now we have this incredibly neat ore, which is depleted in uranium-235 and has all these oddball stable elements, which are leftovers from the fission products. So it's a neat story. And like Rod said, go look up Oklo on Google, and you will find huge amounts of knowledge. And there's not really anything that people have provided to say, no, this didn't happen. It really did happen. And I believe the French scientists who were responsible, they might have gotten the Nobel back in the early 70s when they found it.
All right, I can't remember. Well, I'm starting to wind down. And we've talked a little about the hazards of radiation and the less worrisome effects of low-level radiation. There are natural levels below which there's lots of other things to worry about in your life. Don't get upset about things that are down in the grass. And the next,
somebody's flicking pennies at you and someone's firing a cannon at you, worry about the cannonballs.
Yeah, and if you see a bunch of pennies on the ground, don't worry about picking them up to get rich. Okay. So here's the thing. Next week, we'll talk again and try to share some more interesting, informative stories about atomic energy and its applications.
Absolutely.
Hope you have a great week, Shane, and I'm going to be talking to you from the road next week, so that'll be an interesting experience.
All right. Well, I'll see how recording from my end works, and we'll talk by email between now and then.
And I just want to let you know that I'm going to try not to get too much exposure to ultraviolet radiation as I try to go down to the beach in Florida.
Ultraviolet overdose, a.k.a. sunburn.
Yep. Take care.
All right, Rod. Take care.
Good night, Shane.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Hey, it's Wayne Trammell, host of the Cranky Middle Manager Show. And if you can pull yourself away from the donuts in the break room long enough to listen, I'd sure appreciate it. The Cranky Middle Manager Show on Podcast Network. We have interviews, the classic quote of the week, and, of course, the most honest take on the life of those of us who toil in the honest, hard-working world of middle management. That's the Cranky Middle Manager Show on the Podcast Network. I haven't had this much fun since I found out 360-degree feedback really was anonymous.
This podcast was brought to you by Motorola.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for... Houston, we have a text message. Okay, open. Dude! Huh, that's awesome.